I do believe that I'm trying to make Google and the world in general a better place. I'm not a sexist and I'm not a racist. So I think that's just trying to smear my image rather than actually looking at the evidence.
James Damore, author of the infamous Google memo, speaking with Bloomberg News earlier this week. Damore was fired Monday for writing that biological reasons are partially why more women don't work in tech. His memo and subsequent firing have become a cultural flashpoint in American politics and spawned a week's worth of think pieces. Liberals see Google's decision as a step toward ending Silicon Valley's reputation for rampant sexism. Conservatives, meanwhile, see it as further evidence of a liberal echo chamber in tech that silences free speech. Here to talk about this is Natasha Tiku. She's a senior writer at Wired. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Aaron Gin. He's a veteran of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign and co-founder of the Lincoln Network. That's a group for Silicon Valley libertarians. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Great, thanks. Okay, Natasha, what is the mood now in Silicon Valley since Damore's firing?
Well, I think that they were hoping that a town hall that Google CEO Sundar Pichai was hosting yesterday, was supposed to host yesterday, would kind of be a moment of catharsis or healing for Google internally. But unfortunately, that was canceled partly because of threats to some Google employees who have been outspoken criticizing Damore and his memo, and they have been doxxed. You know, their names and their Twitter accounts have been put up on some conservative and alt-right websites. So I think the mood is very, you know, it was already polarized, and now it's increasingly fractured and tense.
And Aaron, what's the conversation been like within your group, the Lincoln Network?
I think that this has been a almost a surprise at the way that this has elevated so quickly. I think Silicon Valley supposedly prides itself on being a very free-thinking, critical-thinking community, and this sort of situation has escalated to the point of very similar to, like, D.C.-level politics, that everyone jumped on their tribe, and now everyone's pointing, you know, nuclear weapons at each other, waiting to, you know, shoot it off. And, you know, most of us out here, we're just interested in building awesome products, interested in, you know, making, building the future. And, you know, this level of interest and discussion has been definitely distracting and, I think, surprising to many folks.
Yeah. So as you've been thinking about why this is so surprising, what conclusions, if any, have you come to in terms of how did this story become such a big story, Aaron?
I think it's a reflection of our broader culture at the moment, as Natasha alluded to, that we have become a very tribal, very partisan-oriented culture that has, like, spread to all levels of our society. And I think, you know, Silicon Valley isn't immune to that. And because a lot of Silicon Valley is involved in politics, as this last election has demonstrated, and I think that there is signaling happening on both sides that a lot of the, obviously, Google biases towards the more liberal leftist side of the spectrum, and they view this as an encroachment of, like, you know, Trump's continuing to affect our culture versus the Trump more conservative side sees the Silicon Valley controlling more of the narrative, silencing more opinion, seeing it as more, you know, totalitarian. So I think these are just cultural narratives that are floating around and it's just filtering into our ecosystem when, you know, before this, you know, we would, you probably point to 10 years ago, most people in technology had no clue about what was going on in politics because they were building some massive, you know, technology company or new technology. Now it is part of our everyday life.
Mm. Well, Natasha, I wonder if you could pick up on some of that and why this is reverberating so strongly within Silicon Valley and outwards into, as you mentioned, the alt-right media. This guy, you know, he did give an interview to one of the, you know, right-wing YouTube host. I think his name is Stefan Molyneux. Mm-hmm. So James Damore talked to him. How does that change the conversation in Silicon Valley that he is now being embraced by the alt-right?
Right. Well, I think that, yes, there are a number of unique factors that have made this particular story blow up. And part of it has to do with the alt-right taking up the cause, but also part of it has to do with Google right now. They are under intense pressure for the lack of diversity at the company. They are being investigated by the Department of Labor for potential gender pay gap. They are also being investigated by the National Labor Relations Board on two fronts in terms of how whether or not their employees are allowed to organize and whether they have too strong confidentiality clauses. And obviously, this is also happening in the wake of sexual harassment scandals and scandals about the treatment of women at Uber within venture capital. So there is kind of unprecedented scrutiny on Silicon Valley right now and, you know, a sense of a kind of a crisis of conscience and trying to figure out what their self-image is, as Aaron said, in you know, in the wake of the Trump election.
Yeah. So, but what about this alt-right part? I mean, because there's one side of the,
right.
sort of the conservative media saying, look, there is an issue of free speech here, and maybe this guy is a sacrificial lamb in terms of being called to account for all these other things that you just mentioned, the lack of hiring of women, the sexual harassment, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera, and that this guy just happened to be a convenient poster boy for that. And now, though, it seems that because he's giving interviews and being embraced by the alt-right, that it's become something else.
Right. Well, I think for people who initially criticized the memo, they tried to say that despite the fact that James framed the memo as his own interest in you know, having a frank discussion and enhancing diversity, that really that was kind of misleading. Like there was a lot of coded language that that indicated that he believed that women were less qualified, that increasing diversity meant lowering the bar. And his turn towards the alt-right, you know, even if he himself is not espousing the views, the forums in which he is choosing to talk about his case, the people he's not choosing to engage with, I think that is a signal to those critics that they were right, that there was, you know, an underlying discriminatory bias inside the memo.
And Aaron, then, does that, from your perspective, cloud the issue?
Yeah, I think it does, because we're not even talking about the memo anymore.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, what he did after, why the Google CEO said this, why the YouTube CEO said this, and rather than the actual substance of what he was criticizing, and the scientists that actually, and I have not studied science regarding this, but the scientists that he cites have come out in favor, saying he correctly referred to my article. Now, his deductions from that reference may be totally off, may totally disagree with it, whatever, right? But that, like, we're sort of losing track of what initially he was raising as a concern. And I, you know, I think that raising concerns within a company should be healthy, and you should, doesn't, you know, and this is not a, you know, defense of the things that he wrote, but company culture should encourage that sort of discussion. But because of the fact that he felt completely rejected and shamed, he now has jumped to, you know, these more farther right elements because he's finding support there. You know, I have watched his, you know, his interview on Bloomberg, and, you know, to me, he strikes me as a very sort of average type of typical engineer, the way he thinks about issues and in a sense, like the way he processes them. And to me, it seems like a sign of, like, he's going to, he's making a very terrible decision. And since, like, this side is supporting, this other side is not. So I need to find a place where I can go and feel supported. So it's not really encouraging a level of dialogue that I would like, which is generally should be based on sort of empathy and being able to understand another person's perspective. Instead, you know, it's turned into like sort of an Archduke Ferdinand moment for Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. where everyone's putting everything on the line to win their position.
Okay.
Well, I would say that it's not correct that all of the scientists he quoted, you know, supported his theory, or that you know, that he even used reputable science. I think that has become a talking point that he's used on the conservative shows he's gone on. He's saying no one will debate me on the merits of my argument, but it has been you know, I think that people felt that these issues were already decided, but they have engaged again to show flaws in his argument. And, you know, this is a tactic that we've seen to polarize Americans in other issues, too, to just to feel like the spread of misinformation about the memo is, I think, what we're seeing here.
Do you think he should have been fired, Natasha?
You know, I I think that Google was in an incredibly tough position. I genuinely don't know what I would have done in their position, because I think if it hadn't happened at this particular moment, it might have signaled a genuine attempt for Google to show its support for diversity and showcase its values. But coming as it did in the wake of all of this uproar and in the wake of these investigations, it just looked like they were kowtowing to power. And I don't think they gave a explanation that helped people understand, where exactly they lied. And there was never going to be an easy decision. There was never going to be a decision that everyone supported. But I think we still don't really feel like we understand what the conversation was that was happening inside Google.
All right. Well, this conversation, I'm sure, will keep on continuing. This is not the end of it by far. Natasha Tiku, she's senior writer for Wired. Aaron Jin, co-founder of the Lincoln Network. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. What's your take on the DeMore firing? Do you think he should have been fired or not? What do you think about the issues that are being raised and the issues that are being clouded over? You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, a Russian doping heist of epic proportions. Think Ocean's 11 with urine samples instead of cash.
They set up a secret building, a KGB building, where they had a freezer full of all of this clean urine.
The new documentary Icarus, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Brian Fogel noticed something when he first got into amateur bike racing. When Lance Armstrong was caught doping, there was one piece of the puzzle that really didn't add up. Lance had never failed a drug test. So why couldn't the authorities, with their sophisticated machines and elaborate urine testing systems, ever catch him? He was eventually unmasked by his teammates. And so Brian Fogel had an idea. He would inject himself with doping drugs as an experiment to find out how easy it really was to game the system. And that led him to this guy.
You would like to beat doping test. You would like to start your hormonal program.
Yes.
Then give sample and prove negative.
Yes.
Ha ha ha.
Dr. Gregory Rodchenkov, a Russian scientist with a reputation for knowing exactly how to dope athletes without getting caught. And that's because he ran the Olympic anti-doping lab in Moscow. But Brian soon found himself tangled in a doping scandal of epic proportions, one that went all the way to the top of the Russian government. He tells the story in a new first-person documentary called Icarus, and Brian Fogel joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
You began this process when you were training for this huge amateur race, which seems impossible, super, super hard, like the Tour de France times 10. And so why did you want to do this doping experiment on yourself?
As a lifelong passionate cyclist, I never turned pro, but for many years of my life growing up, I wanted to be a pro. And I always had this curiosity as to what exactly do these performance-enhancing drugs do? Because they're being kind of played in society as that this will create you superpowers, that, you know, you'd be Lance Armstrong if you took these things. So I was very curious on a personal level. And then on a scientific sport level, I was just dumbfounded how the most tested athlete on planet Earth to this day has never been caught.
150 times over the last 6 years I've been tested. In competition, out of competition, at home, at a race, 7 in the morning, 7 at night, whatever, and they're all clean.
And what seemed to be a spectacular inadequacy of the system in place to test athletes and what it meant for all of sport. And so I went on this personal journey of A, doping myself, but B, doping myself to evade detection to see what it meant on a larger perspective for all athletes across all sport.
And you dope yourself and you don't do well. You don't do better than you did when you weren't doped.
I certainly didn't do as well as I had hoped to do, which I had hoped to win. But I will tell you the difference between the first year I did that race through the French Alps and finished 14th clean. I couldn't walk for 3 weeks after that. I was in physical therapy. I had Achilles tendonitis. I had hip dysplasia. The second year where I doped, at the end of 7 days, not only was I able to walk, had the race been another week long, I would have had no problem with that. My hip dysplasia was gone. My Achilles tendonitis was gone. And I was recovering spectacularly. In fact, a physiotherapist that was massaging me every day kept looking at me at the end of every day's race going, huh, well, something's wrong. Your muscles are not deteriorating. So it was a big difference.
Interesting. And this was using testosterone mainly?
I was using testosterone, I was using HGH, I was using EPO, erythropoietin, DHEA, HCG, thyroid, and all sorts of various vitamin injections.
Wow. Okay, so you are helped along this journey of doping. You're helped by this guy, Dr. Gregory Rodchenkov, who is this amiable character, and he is happy to help you win unethically, win this race. He comes to LA and helps you smuggle your urine samples out of the country. It's really extraordinary. He agrees to be filmed on Skype this whole time. Why was he so eager to help you and to help you on film, to be recorded, and to seemingly have no problem helping you do something that was illegal and unethical?
I mean, that is certainly a question I have asked myself 1,000 times, because it was kind of mind-boggling and head-scratching to me that he had agreed to help me in the first place. But I think in his mind, he was kind of going, well, he's an amateur, so it doesn't really matter. And also, I mean, this was a guy who had essentially been doing that his whole life, and he also believed that the anti-doping system was a fraud, and he had, you know, reason to believe that firsthand. And I think there was a part of him that was getting enjoyment out of showing how inept he thought the system was.
So you want me to do 24,000 units in 1 month?
Yes, we are imitating, we are reproducing Lance Armstrong's scenario.
I'm getting kind of bruises all over my legs.
Don't disturb your diet at all. Stop it. You can inject into your thigh muscle.
So he is the main, I guess, the main doper of the Russian athletes during the 2014 Sochi Olympics. He comes up with the doping system, right?
I mean, the spectacular thing about Gregory is his work was technically as the anti-doping lab director, but what he really was the anti-doping lab director. And not only that, he was figuring out the protocols and detection methods and science to essentially allow all of Russia's athletes to evade positive detection. And I think the one thing you have to think about here is that Russia, unlike the United States, for example, all of sport is under the ministry, meaning sport is a government operation. And what that means is that all of the athletes in Russia are essentially being paid or supported by the Russian government to compete for Russia. So everything that Gregory was doing was essentially under the Russian ministry. So what they had put in place was this spectacular, well-planned system where they had collected the clean urine of all the Russian athletes that were going to be competing in Sochi about a year prior. And then they held all these urine in storage. They brought them to Sochi. They set up a secret building, a KGB building, where they had a freezer full of all of this clean urine. And in the dark of night, every night of Sochi, they were swapping out the Russian samples that were dirty and steroid-filled for clean samples of the same athlete. So literally, all the Russian athletes were going into these Olympics games taking a full protocol of steroids, and they were able to literally dump out the dirty urine and swap in clean urine so that none of the Russian athletes would be caught.
And how is this all revealed?
November 2015, a report breaks, an investigation breaks, that is alleging that Gregory is this mastermind of a state-sponsored program. But at the time, the investigation is centered only on track and field, so they're only looking at athletics. But it's damning enough that Gregory is forced to resign from a lab, the lab is shut down, and Russia is suspended from world track and field.
Decision time for the IAAF on whether Russia's track and field athletes will be allowed to compete at the Rio Olympics.
At the same time, on state television, Vitaly Mutko, who's the sport minister for all of Russia, is on TV emphatically denying these allegations.
The sports minister, Vitaly Mutko, has said Russia took all the necessary measures, he says, to fight the doping problem. Moscow's anti-doping lab was recently recognized as one of the best in the world.
And then the next day, Putin is on television. Not only emphatically denying the allegations, but saying that anybody who did this, it was the individual, not the state, and it will be the individual who is punished and held accountable. And that right there was essentially Gregory's death sentence. Because knowing what I now know, there is not a single chance in hell that Gregory would still be alive if he was in Russia today.
Okay.
I'm going to get the flight for you right now.
Yes, right now.
Okay.
He tells me that he has received words from other friends in the FSB that they are plotting his suicide and that he needs to escape. And I help him get from Moscow to Los Angeles. And over the next 6 months, we navigate a spectacular set of pitfalls to bring this story and all of his evidence to the New York Times.
Grigory Rodchenkov told the New York Times he created a cocktail of drugs for a state-run doping program that included 15 medal winners.
Oh my gosh. So, of course, little did you know when you first started this journey 2 years prior that you would end up as a key element in this worldwide scandal.
That is correct. So we literally go to the Times, and then a whole other investigation gets launched, and they come forward on the eve of the Rio Games with a staggering amount of evidence saying that all of this happened, as Gregory said, and every world leader in sport called for the banning of Russia from the Rio Games, and the Olympics, the IOC, turned its back on every single clean athlete on planet Earth, turned its back on its own credo, and allowed Russia into the Rio Olympics.
Why did it do that?
Well, the answer to me is very clear. First of all, you have a long-standing relationship between Vladimir Putin and Thomas Bach, who's the president of the IOC. Russia hosted the Sochi Games, which was to the tune of $50 billion. Second of all, you know, the Olympics at the end of the day are really just a huge, huge, huge business.
Well, I guess the question I had was, is it just Russia? Or other countries, maybe China, for example, are they also doping?
Oh, clearly it is not just Russia. In fact, Gregory told me, and this is not something that I can corroborate, but Gregory told me that he got the idea to swap the urine, in fact, from the Chinese, because he was at the Beijing Olympics. And if you look at the medal count of the Beijing Olympics, China essentially swept those games.
First gold medal for China at their Olympics.
It was a platform for China to assert itself as a world power.
It is China for the gold medal!
To show the world that they were a first world country. And according to Gregory, the mandate was essentially the same from China as it was from Russia, win at all cost. And according to Gregory, China swapped the urine.
So Gregory, he is somewhere here in the United States. We don't know. He's in the witness protection program.
He is in protective custody, and he's been there for a year and 2 months. And you know, funny enough, the the, you know, the fingers of this go so wide is that in January of this year, when the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA released their declassified report into why our election was hacked, they had seven reasons, and reason number three was for what they believed was the revenge of Putin for the breaking of this doping scandal, which embarrassed Russia and has continued to embarrass Russia, and the leaking of the Panama Papers, both of which he viewed the United States being involved in. So there seems to be kind of long-reaching effects of this. And if you look at the timeline from May 12th, when the New York Times story breaks, the DNC hack is literally almost 30 days later in the middle of June.
But here you started out with a pretty small-ish project, a personal journey, like a Super Size Me movie, and you ended up being the center of this enormous scandal that had its now has its tentacles, as you say, in the 2016 election and the hacking. So, I mean, how do you personally feel about that? I know that Sundance was hacked in January when your movie was being shown, when it premiered. So how do you personally feel about being at the center of this, or being a key ingredient to it?
You know, I certainly don't know in regards to Sundance if that is why or why not they were hacked. You know, I know Gregory's emails were hacked. They had his family under surveillance. They tape recorded his Skype calls. In regards to being in the center of this, you know, it was nothing that I could have imagined. I didn't set out to tell this story from the beginning. The fact that what has happened in the last, you know, 6-7 months of our news cycle, where Russia is now front and center in the world again, and we're seeing to the extent to which they are willing to meddle into world affairs, this film couldn't be more timely, because it literally shines a spotlight into the Kremlin and how Russian government is organized and what they are essentially doing to corrupt world sport, world business, politics, geopolitics, etc., and the extent to which they are willing to go to win at all costs. And I think that is important takeaway from this film.
Are you concerned for your personal safety?
I've been asked this many times, and you know, I would hope that, you know, you don't shoot the messenger.
But do you think you're being monitored at all by Russian authorities, or I don't know? Are you kind of worried about being watched, surveilled by them?
I mean, I know that I was for a period of time. That I'm certain of. Whether or not I'm still a target, I don't know. But you know, there are a lot of journalists in this world and filmmakers in this world that have exposed you know, other stories of consequence, and I hope I'll be okay.
Brian Fogel, he's the director of the new documentary Icarus. The film is streaming now on Netflix. Brian, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the program, feature film reviews, including an Aubrey Plaza comedy called Ingrid Goes West, in which Ingrid moves to LA to meet one of her Instagram obsessions and hooks up with her neighbor,
a pot-smoking landlord who's obsessed with Batman.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Plus, the trip guys, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, they go to Spain. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A couple of older men eating their way around Spain and a couple of younger women living their best lives on Instagram. Those are a couple of the options waiting for you at the movie theater this weekend. And for some previews and advice, joining me in the studio, April Wolf, lead film critic for the LA Weekly. Hello.
Hi.
And Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango and the author of Backwards and in Heels, The Past, Present, and Future of Women Working in Film. Hi.
Hi.
All right. For you, Alicia, The Glass Castle. This is an adaptation of a memoir by Jeanette Walls about her crazy childhood. It stars Brie Larson, Woody Harrelson, and Naomi Watts.
We'd have to be out of our minds to trade places with any of them.
Dr. Taylor said we should be going to real school.
A real school, huh?
This is as real as it gets, kids. You learn from living.
Okay, Woody Harrelson there playing the wacky dad. What did you think?
Well, he is fantastic. And I mean, that clip kind of sets it up almost like it's a Captain Fantastic type of situation, an unconventional upbringing that ends up being great. But actually, it shows a very abusive relationship. The father is an alcoholic. He gets quite scary when he's drunk. He abuses his wife, played by Naomi Watts. And the children live in horrible situations, basically homeless and squatting from place to place. They end up having to take care of themselves and try to escape their situation. So it flashes back and forth in time. You've got Brie Larson playing the older Jeanette Walls in the 80s, and then it flashes back to her childhood. And so it sets up, I think, quite an emotional situation where you really feel for the characters. Quite long, but I was into it until the end when they try to wrap things up in a nice happy bow. And that, to me, just didn't fit with the rest of the movie.
Right, because you're living in the squalor with the kids, kind of horrified, and then it's all
and it's
happy.
Like, oh, and maybe it wasn't so bad. And he was just fun.
I got a bestseller out of it.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So great performances, and it had me for most of the film, but just let it down at the end.
Okay, let's move on to, this should be called Instagram the Movie, but it's Ingrid Goes West, and it stars Elizabeth Olsen as an Instagram influencer and Aubrey Plaza as her stalker slash friend.
The couple that yogas together stays together. Hashtag perfect.
True romance vibes.
Hashtag yes. Perfect.
Congratulations.
April, what did you think?
I love this film. It was so surprising to me. You can never tell from the trailers what this is going to be like because the tone isn't quite, you know, happy, happy, funny, you know, a rollicking roller coaster of a great time. There are some emotional things. So Aubrey Plaza, who plays Ingrid, she is dealing with a grief, a loss of her mother. And so she moves out west to Los Angeles and kind of becomes a stalker to Elizabeth Olsen's character. And she thinks that she knows her, but she doesn't. And so you see this kind of butting up of real life against Instagram life. And it's not as cheesy as you think. Like, I don't think that this is, you know, like a preachy thing. Like, don't get on Instagram. Mm. Don't live your life online. It's more a piece about grief and not being able to connect. And I have to say that O'Shea Jackson Jr. and Aubrey Plaza together have a phenomenal on-screen relationship. And in fact, Aubrey Plaza,
he plays her boyfriend character.
He plays her love interest who's like, what, a pot-smoking landlord who's obsessed with Batman.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he has such charisma. And we saw that in Straight Outta Compton where he was playing his father, but now we get to see him in a different role. He really stood out to me in this film and he was a welcome presence in every scene. Also love Aubrey Plaza in this movie and she compares her character to Rupert Pumpkin from The King of Comedy.
Oh, right.
And you can see that
Robert
similarities where it's just, she is crazy, but you really do feel for her because she has something more going on underneath.
Yeah, and she gets to be a little bit emotional here too.
Yes.
You know, she's breaking into tears. This is new territory for her. And I love seeing her get to do a role like this. But she did also produce this film and wanted it to be what it could be. There's so many actors who see a script, but it's not the final product and you don't know how it's going to end up. But she was like, yes, I see this and I want to see it through. She was in charge of casting O'Shea Jackson Jr., got him. It was supposed to be a nerdy guy and really could have ended up just being, you know, probably white. And then it turned into something very different, casting O'Shea Jackson Jr.
And he apparently does really love Batman. So
most
of the scenes where he talks about Batman is actually genuinely him. So I love that.
I love the scenes, because I saw this movie too, I love the sort of sarcastic scenes, I don't know, pillaring the Silver Lake Shaman kind of aesthetic yeah. that LA has become yes. so known for.
It's painful to watch yeah. because you do see, I mean, if you live in Los Angeles, you see a little bit of yourself and some of these people. And so it's a real dirty mirror to look into.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. A carefully curated, very filtered mirror that we see yes. through Instagram.
But I have to say, the end, though, is it's scary. You see a woman who is completely unhinged.
Yes.
And it's not, this is funny kind of Instagram stalking. It's scary to see kind of the face of this mental illness. And it's not played for laughs at all.
Yeah, no. And she's completely alone as well, which mm-hmm. is really sad.
And I would say it's somewhat more of a thriller because my stomach was tensing up as I was watching her interact with people, knowing that it was all going to fall apart, that yeah. this kind of persona that she had adopted was not going to last. So in some parts, some of the filming actually looks like a David Fincher film, yeah. like the cinematography and the lighting. It's so strange, but they have such a great tone here.
Okay, let's move on to the trip to Spain. And this is the third of a series.
Rob, Steve Coogan. Just got back from filming in New York.
They want me to do publicity.
A series of restaurant reviews. This time, a trip to Spain.
Yes, I will come.
Okay, Rob Brydon there, looking at a screaming child and not hesitating to go on another trip with Steve Coogan. Alicia, yeah. what did you think?
I love these movies. I love the previous two, Trip to Italy, and then the original, The Trip. And I love the way that Steve and Rob play versions of themselves, and they're not afraid to go for semi-unlikable versions of themselves, where they compete with each other about who's more successful and who has a better life, single life versus married with kids. It's got all the same ingredients from the previous two, the impersonations, all the delicious food, and some of the same side characters coming back again. But if you love the previous two, then like me, you'll just gobble it up.
How much of it is improvised, do you think?
I think quite a lot.
I think quite a bit, yeah.
Mm. It feels very real.
Yeah, it seems like maybe even if they didn't improvise in scene, they were improvising before the scene and maybe got their script from that as well, so...
So the famous scene from the first one was the impersonation of Michael Caine.
Oh, it's there.
And they do it again?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's there. There's David Bowie. There's Michael Caine.
There's Mick Jagger.
There's Mick Jagger. Yeah.
Yeah. There's James Bond as well. Like, come, Mr. Bond. Oh, I just love them. They're so good at impersonations. And so even though some people might go, well, it's the same thing, I really enjoyed it.
Well, I thought this one actually evolved a little bit too, because you see this with the law of diminishing returns. They're growing older. They're a little bit more disappointed with their lives than they were before. So this one is a little bit, you know, despite them drinking a lot of wine, it's a bit more sobering. Mm. These are men who are lost in the world. And there's a really great Don Quixote theme that they have going on where they're kind of,
well,
you know,
it is Spain.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're, you know, they're wandering in the wilderness of their lives. And so to me, this one evolved into, a little bit darker than the previous ones, just a tinge of, you know, this is probably going to end.
Maybe not. Maybe there'll be a fourth one. Maybe they'll go to Mars or something.
I know. Yeah. Oh my God. The trip to Mars.
Trip to Mars. I do love the way that they're getting older and they really focus on that, and you see them not being able to do the things that they used to do, like running and cycling and everything, but they're just so sweet. And yeah. I love them together. Such a great
chemistry.
Well,
in one of them, I can't remember which one, Steve Coogan, again, it sort of ends up in a sad place. He's sort of living alone in this bachelor pad.
Yes.
And he doesn't really have...
Obsessed with a married younger woman.
Yeah.
Yes.
So does he at least have some kind of love life to speak of?
It's complicated.
Yeah. I won't give that away.
Yeah.
All right. And so Rob is still dealing with the domestic bliss,
yes.
not bliss.
Yeah, exactly. Being married, having kids and having all that. And I like the way that it's always the grass is greener with these two, that they see each other's lives and they think, well, maybe that would be nice, but I also have this. And so there's great camaraderie with them.
And then these movies always make me really hungry.
I know. I wish they played them in dine-in theaters. That's what I want. I want to be served the same food that they're eating.
That's a
on
great
screen
idea.
At the same time. Yeah.
Might cost a little bit more.
Yeah.
Okay. So finally, I guess there's a horror movie to round out this week. This one's called Annabelle Creation. It's part of the series that started with The Conjuring. And here's a clip.
We prayed to see our beloved girl again. The contact started small. Then it wanted permission to move into a doll so that it could be with us forever. We said yes.
This sounds like every single horror film I've ever seen.
I know, it is, and it's very effective at what it does. I went and saw this one last night. I say saw, but I was looking through my hands most of the time because it's one of those films that it doesn't necessarily add anything new to the horror genre, but it definitely does what it does really well. So all those jump scares, you know, there's moments of silence and you know that it's coming, but you still jump every single time. This one stars two Australian actors, Anthony LaPaglia and Miranda Otto, playing parents who lose their daughter. The daughter they think goes into the doll ends up being a demon. They decide to open up their house to become an orphanage for young girls, and I think you can guess what happens. Right. So it has creepy dolls, it has little children, it's got nuns, it's got all the things that terrify me, and I was just scared the whole time.
Is this something you're going to check out or not, April?
Oh, no, this is exactly my thing.
It is?
I was so sad that I missed the screening. Like, I'm so sad. I need to see this immediately.
Well, you have all weekend ahead of you, so
I know
what you're doing.
I've got my plan together.
Okay. Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango, April Wolf, lead film critic for LA Weekly. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, an investigation into which companies make products for Trader Joe's and why they're willing to sell them for 30% less. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. All right, we're going to dig into the big unmasking scandal now, the one at Trader Joe's. The grocery chain is notoriously tight-lipped about its suppliers. Trader Joe's, as you probably know, doesn't actually make those peanut butter-filled pretzels or the JoJo's or that cheese that's really good and really reasonably priced. So who does? Vince Dixon, a journalist with Eater, tried to find out, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so we joke about this as a big sort of cloak and dagger kind of thing, but you had to do some real investigative reporting to try to figure out who makes some of these products. What did you do?
So I submitted a FOIA request for recalls that mentioned Trader Joe's in the last 10 years, and that's how we unveiled some of the dozens of companies that provide Trader Joe's products.
So you looked at the recalls for Trader Joe's products and matched them up with recalls of other manufacturers' products that were the same?
So the manufacturers actually issue some of the recalls.
Oh.
And when they issue the recalls, they list every store and brand that the product is sold under. So if Trader Joe's happened to carry pistachios that were recalled, Wonderful Pistachio will list Trader Joe's on their recall. And that's how we found the connection.
Okay. So speaking of this pistachios, these are the pistachios that say Trader Joe's on them, and they're actually made by Palm Wonderful or Wonderful?
The Wonderful Pistachio Company. So they make the pistachios with the green lettering and the black packages.
Yeah.
They make, or at least at some point, they made Trader Joe's pistachios.
Okay. And then also their smoothies, like mango smoothies, green smoothies. Mm-hmm. Who makes those?
So we discovered that Naked Juice, which is a subsidiary of PepsiCo, actually provided Trader Joe's with some of their protein smoothies. So it just comes to show that a lot of really large companies that we all know and love are behind some of these small or seemingly small Trader Joe's products.
Huh. And for a lot less, right? At Trader Joe's, they're a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm. About 37% cheaper at Trader Joe's.
Huh.
For the same product.
So what is the advantage for these companies to sell these products under a Trader Joe's brand?
Well, in private labeling, a lot of the times companies will like to reach out to different consumers. So people who may not think they can afford Wonderful Pistachios or people who are looking for something a little bit more behind their products, such as healthiness or a story. And Trader Joe's especially really specializes in adding this sort of quirky, unique specialty image behind a lot of its products. So this is a way for companies to reach consumers who are not looking for brands, but are looking for quirkiness or stories behind their products, or something a little more special than what a name brand can give them.
But it's the same product.
It's the same product usually, or sometimes they may use different formulas to sort of cater to the needs of the retailers.
Can you taste the difference?
So we conducted a taste test, actually, to see if we can taste the difference. About 30 participants tasted Trader Joe's products and their name brand counterparts, and some people could taste differences between some of the products. And this is because sometimes Trader Joe's may alter some of the ingredients in the name brand products, and you can actually sort of taste these alterations. However, our tasters thought that Trader Joe's tasted better than the name brand products. Hmm. So,
okay, so that seems like a win-win. Tastes better and they're cheaper. What has Trader Joe's said about your investigation?
So Trader Joe's is notoriously tight-lipped about the entire business. So I haven't heard from them at all, and they haven't commented or announced anything, and I don't think they will.
But you think they'd want to trumpet that, the fact that they have the same products for a third less?
I think they care more about creating this image of offering unique brands. I don't think they want to confirm or deny that they have any association with the name brand products that you can get at a local supermarket. They want you to think that Trader Joe is providing you all of the products that you can buy at Trader Joe's.
Okay, whoever Trader Joe might be.
Uh-huh.
All right, did you ever find out who makes the JoJo's?
No, there were some products that we looked at, for instance, the cookie butter and the JoJo's and the Scandinavian swimmers, which are suspiciously similar to Swedish fish. Mm. And there were some products that we just couldn't find a match for. So maybe these products are produced by smaller companies or using formulas that the bigger companies are not using in the United States or that we're familiar with.
Okay, so personally, were you a Trader Joe's shopper?
Yes, actually, I was a huge fan of Trader Joe's when I lived in Manhattan, mostly because it was so affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a lifesaver back in those days. I still try to get cookie butter there when I can or certain products.
Yeah, cookie butter is pretty good. I personally like those peanut butter filled pretzels.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know who makes those?
Actually, those were, I believe, on the recall list at some point, and it's a it's a smaller company that produces those peanut butter apps.
Oh, okay. Vince Dixon, he's a data visualization reporter for Eater, where you can check out the unmasking of Trader Joe's products and see who makes what. Vince, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Quinn O'Toole here with some feedback.
Yeah, well, a couple people really didn't want to hear that last segment. You can say,
la, 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 la.
The Joe Pearson from Palmdale says someone is spoiling the Trader Joe's mystery for the rest of us. Our producer Gina seconded that. She said it's like somebody told her the Tooth Fairy isn't real. But this guy, Monty Monaco, writes that it makes a lot more sense than the ideas that were bandied about in his office. He says one guy thought Trader Joe's had a cult farm someplace in Wyoming making these little treats. Somebody thought they had really smart people reverse engineering the products. That's not too far-fetched. But it seems like it generates a lot of conversation in the office at Trader Joe's.
I think they like that mystery, Trader Joe's. They just kind of stoke it, and they want people to feel kind of proprietary about it.
Well, we can't talk politics anymore at the office, so it's
we have to talk Trader Joe's
and freeways.
What's your favorite Trader Joe's product? Since we're not talking about politics.
What a great question. Salted almonds.
So good. The roasted salted almonds.
Yeah, it's nice stuff.
What about that brioche bread?
I don't do the brioche is not my thing, but they used to have pizzas. I ate a lot of those pizzas at one time in my life.
Okay. Appears to be lunchtime. Quinn O'Toole, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.